handed me the creel, the lid was still hanging back on its cunning little leather hinges. I looked inside and saw nothing but two handfuls of grass. "Thought you said you caught a rainbow," my father said. "But maybe you dreamed that, too." Something in his voice stung me. "No, sir," I said. "I caught one." "Well, it sure as hell didn't flop out, not if it was gutted and cleaned. And you wouldn't put a catch into your fisher box without doing that, would you, Gary? I taught you better than that."
"Yes, sir, you did, but..."
"So if you didn't dream catching it, and if it was dead in the box, something must have come along and eaten it," my father said. And then he grabbed another quick glance over his shoulder, eyes wide, as if he'd heard something move in the woods. I wasn't exactly surprised to see drops of sweat standing out on his forehead like big, clear jewels. "Come on," he said. "Let's get the hell out of here." I was for that, and we went back along the bank to the bridge, walking quick without speaking. When we got there, my dad dropped to one knee and examined the place where we'd found my rod. There was another patch of dead grass there, and the lady's slipper was all brown and curled in on itself, as if a blast of heat had charred it. While my father did this, I looked in my empty creel. "He must have gone back and eaten my other fish, too," I said. My father looked up at me.
"Other fish?"
"Yes, sir, I didn't tell you, but I caught a brookie, too, a big one. He was awful hungry, that fella." I wanted to say more, and the words trembled just behind my lips. But in the end, I didn't. We climbed up to the bridge and helped one another over the railing. My father took my creel, looked into it, then went to the railing and threw it over. I came up beside him in time to see it splash down and float away like a boat, riding lower and lower in the stream as the water poured in between the wicker weavings. "It smelled bad," my father said, but he didn't look at me when he said it, and his voice sounded oddly defensive. It was the only time I ever heard him speak just that way.
"Yes, sir."
"We'll tell your mother we couldn't find it if she asks." "If she doesn't ask, we won't tell her anything."
"No, sir, we won't."
And she didn't, and we didn't, and that's the way it was. That day in the woods is 81 years gone, and for many of the years in between, I have never even thought of it. Not awake, at least. Like any other man or woman who ever lived, I can't say about my dreams, not for sure. But now I'm old, and I dream awake, it seems. My infirmities have crept up like waves which will soon take a child's abandoned sandcastle, and my memories have also crept up, making me think of some old rhyme that went in part, "Just leave them alone, and they'll come home, wagging their tails behind them." I remember meals I ate, games I played, girls I kissed in the school cloakroom when we played post office, boys I chummed with, the first drink I ever took, the first cigarette I ever smoked, corn shuck behind Dickie Hammer's pig shed, and I threw up. Yet of all the memories, the one of the man in the black suit is the strongest, and glows with its own spectral haunted light. He was real. He was the devil. And that day, I was either his errand or his luck. I feel more and more strongly that escaping him was my luck, just luck, and not the intercession of the God I have worshipped and sung hymns to all my life. As I lie here in my nursing home room, and in the ruined sandcastle that is my body, I tell myself that I need not fear the devil, that I have lived a good, kindly life, and I need not fear the devil. Sometimes I remind myself that it was I, not my father, who finally coaxed my mother back to church later on that summer. In the dark, however, these thoughts have no power to ease or comfort. In the dark comes a voice which whispers that the 9-year-old boy I was had done nothing for which he might legitimately fear the devil either. And yet the devil came. And in the dark I sometimes hear that voice drop even lower into ranges which are inhuman. Big fish, it whispers, in tones of hushed greed, and all the truths of the moral world fall to ruin before its hunger. Big fish. The devil came to me once, long ago. Suppose he were to come again now. I am too old to run now. I can't even get to the bathroom and back without my walker. I have no fine large brook trout with which to propitiate him either, even for a moment or two. I am old, and my creel is empty. Suppose he were to come back and find me so. And suppose he is still hungry.
That you love will be carried away. Read by Peter Garrity.
It was a Motel 6 on I-80 just west of Lincoln, Nebraska. The snow that began at mid-afternoon had faded the sign's virulent yellow to a kinder pastel shade as the light ran out of the January dusk. The wind was closing in on that quality of empty amplification one encounters only in the country's flat midsection, usually in wintertime. That meant nothing but discomfort now, but if big snow came tonight, the weather forecasters couldn't seem to make up their minds, then the interstate would be shut down by morning. That was nothing to Alfie Zimmer. He got his key from a man in a red vest, drove down to the end of the long cinder block building. He had been selling in the Midwest for 20 years and had formulated 4 basic rules about securing his night's rest. First, always reserve ahead. Second, reserve at a franchise motel if possible. Your Holiday Inn, your Ramada Inn, your Comfort Inn, your Motel 6. Third, always ask for a room on the end. That way the worst you could have was one set of noisy neighbors. Last, ask for a room that begins with a 1. Alfie was 44, too old to be fucking truck stop whores, eating chicken fried steak, or hauling his luggage upstairs. These days, the rooms on the first floor were usually reserved for non-smokers. Alfie rented them and smoked anyway. Someone had taken the space in front of room 190. All the spaces along the building were taken. Alfie wasn't surprised. You could make a reservation, guarantee it, but if you arrived late, late on a day like this was after 4 p.m., you had to park and walk. The cars belonging to the early birds were nestled up to the gray cinder block and the bright yellow doors in a long line, their windows already covered with a scrim of light snow. Alfie drove round the corner and parked with the nose of his Chevrolet pointed at the white expanse of some farmer's field, swimming deep into the gray of day's end. At the farthest limit of vision, he could see the spark lights of a farm. In there, they would be hunkered down. Out here, the wind blew hard enough to rock the car. Snow skated past, obliterating the farm lights for a few moments. Alfie was a big man with a florid face and a smoker's noisy respiration. He was wearing a top coat, because when you were selling, that was what people liked to see, not a jacket. Storekeepers sold to people wearing jackets and John Deere caps. They didn't buy from them. The room key lay on the seat beside him. It was attached to a diamond of green plastic. The key was a real key, not a mag card. On the radio, Clint Black was singing Nothing But the Taillights. It was a country song. Lincoln had an FM rocker now, but rock and roll music didn't seem right to Alfie. Not out here, where if you switched over to AM, you could still hear angry old men calling down hellfire. He shut off the engine, put the key to 190 in his pocket, and checked to make sure he still had his notebook in there, too. His old pal. "Save Russian Jews," he said, reminding himself. "Collect valuable prizes." He got out of the car and a gust of wind hit him hard, rocking him back on his heels, flapping his pants around his legs, making him laugh a smoker's surprise rattlebox laugh. His samples were in the trunk, but he wouldn't need them tonight. No, not tonight, not at all. He took his suitcase and his briefcase out of the back seat, shut the door, then pushed the black button on his key fob. That one locked all the doors. The red one set off an alarm, what you were supposed to use if you were going to get mugged. Alfie had never been mugged. He guessed that few salesmen of gourmet foods were, especially in this part of the country. There was a market for gourmet foods in Nebraska, Iowa, Oklahoma, and Kansas, even in the Dakotas, although many might not believe it. Alfie had done quite well, especially over the last 2 years as he got to know the market's deeper creases. But it was never going to equal the market for, let's say, fertilizer, which he could smell even now on the winter wind that was freezing his cheeks and turning them an even darker shade of red. He stood where he was a moment longer waiting for the wind to drop. It did, and he could see the spark lights again, the farmhouse. And was it possible that behind those lights, some farmer's wife was even now heating up a pot of cottager split-pea soup, or perhaps microwaving a cottager shepherd's pie or chicken francais? It was. It was possible as hell. While her husband watched the early news with his shoes off and his sock feet on a hassock, and overhead their son played a video game on his GameCube, and their daughter sat in the tub, chin-deep in fragrant bubbles, her hair tied up with a ribbon reading The Golden Compass by Philip Pullman, or perhaps one of the Harry Potter books, which were favorites of Alfie's daughter, Carlene. All that going on behind the sparklights, some family's universal joint turning smoothly in its socket. But between them and the edge of this parking lot was a mile and a half of flat field, white in the running away light of a low sky, comatose with the season. Alfie briefly imagined himself walking into that field in his city shoes, his briefcase in one hand and his suitcase in the other, working his way across the frozen furrows, finally arriving, knocking. The door would be opened and he would smell pea soup, that good hearty smell, and hear the KETV meteorologist in the other room saying, "But now look at this low pressure system just coming over the Rockies." And what would Alfie say to the farmer's wife? That he just dropped by for dinner? Would he advise her to save Russian Jews, collect valuable prizes? Would he begin by saying, "Ma'am, according to at least one source I've read recently, all that you love will be carried away"? That would be a good conversation opener, sure to interest the farmer's wife and the wayfaring stranger who had just walked across her husband's east field to knock on her door. And when she invited him to step in, to tell her more, he could open his briefcase and give her a couple of his sample books, tell her that once she discovered the Cottager brand of quick-serve gourmet delicacies, she would almost certainly want to move on to the more sophisticated pleasures of Ma Mère. And, by the way, did she have a taste for caviar? Many did, even in Nebraska. Freezing. Standing here and freezing. He turned from the field and the spark lights at the far end of it and walked to the motel, moving in careful duck steps so he wouldn't go ass over teakettle. He had done it before, God knew, whoops-a-daisy, in 50 motel parking lots. He had done most of it before, actually, and supposed that was at least part of the problem. There was an overhang, so he was able to get out of the snow. There was a Coke machine with a sign saying, "Use correct change." There was an ice machine and a snacks machine with candy bars and various kinds of potato chips behind curls of metal like bedsprings, There was no use correct change sign on the snacks machine. From the room to the left of the one where he intended to kill himself, Alfie could hear the early news, but it would sound better in that farmhouse over yonder. He was sure of that. The wind boomed. Snow swirled around his city shoes, and then Alfie let himself into his room. The light switch was to the left. He turned it on and shut the door. He knew the room. It was the room of his dreams. It was square. The walls were white. On one was a picture of a small boy in a straw hat, asleep with a fishing pole in his hand. There was a green rug on the floor, a quarter inch of some nubbly synthetic stuff. It was cold in here right now, but when he pushed the high heat button on the control panel of the climatron beneath the window, the place would warm up fast, would probably become hot. A counter ran the length of one wall. There was a TV on it. On top of the TV was a piece of cardboard with one-touch movies printed on it. There were twin double beds, each covered with bright gold spreads that had been tucked under the pillows and then pulled over them, so the pillows looked like the corpses of infants. There was a table between the beds with a Gideon Bible, a TV channel guide, and a flesh-colored phone on it. Beyond the second bed was the door to the bathroom. When you turned on the light in there, the fan would go on, too. If you wanted the light, you got the fan, too. There was no way around it. The light itself would be fluorescent, with the ghosts of dead flies inside. On the counter beside the sink, there would be a hot plate, and a Proctor Silex electric kettle, and little packets of instant coffee. There was a smell in here, a mingling of some harsh cleaning fluid and mildew on the shower curtain. Alfie knew it all. He had dreamed it right down to the green rug. But that was no accomplishment. It was an easy dream. He thought about turning on the heater, but that would rattle, too, and besides, what was the point? Alfie unbuttoned his topcoat and put his suitcase on the floor at the foot of the bed closest to the bathroom. He put his briefcase on the gold coverlet. He sat down, the sides of his coat spreading out like the skirt of a dress. He opened his briefcase, thumbed through the various brochures, catalogs, and order forms. Finally, he found the gun. It was a Smith & Wesson revolver, .38 caliber. He put it on the pillows at the head of the bed. He lit a cigarette, reached for the telephone, then remembered his notebook. He reached into his right coat pocket and pulled it out. It was an old spiral, bought for $1.49 in the stationery department of some forgotten five and dime in Omaha or Sioux City, or maybe Jubilee, Kansas. The cover was creased and almost completely innocent of any printing it might once have borne. Some of the pages had pulled partially free of the metal coil that served as the notebook's binding, but all of them were still there. Alfie had been carrying this notebook for almost 7 years, ever since his days selling universal product code readers for Simonix. There was an ashtray on the shelf under the phone. Out here, some of the motel rooms still came with ashtrays, even on the first floor. Alfie fished for it, put his cigarette on the groove, and opened his notebook. He flipped through pages written with 100 different pens and a few pencils, pausing to read a couple of entries. One read, "I sucked Jim Morrison's cock with my pouty boy mouth. Lawrence, Kansas." Restrooms were filled with homosexual graffiti, most of it tiresome and repetitive. But pouty boy mouth was pretty good. Another was, "Albert Gore is my favorite whore, Murdo, South Dakota." The last page, three-quarters of the way through the book, had just two entries. "Don't chew the Trojan gum, it tastes just like rubber, Avoca, Iowa." And, "Poopy doopy, you so loopy, Papillion, Nebraska." Alfie was crazy about that one. Something about the I-E, I-E, and then, boom, you got Y. It could have been no more than an illiterate's mistake. He was sure that that would have been Mara's take on it. But why think like that? What fun was that? No, Alfie preferred even now to believe that I-E, I-E, wait for it, Y, was an intended construction. Something sneaky but playful, with the feel of an E.E. Cummings poem. He rummaged through the stuff in his inside coat pocket, feeling papers, an old toll ticket, a bottle of pills, stuff he had quit taking, and at last finding the pen that always hid in the litter, Time to record today's finds. Two good ones, both from the same rest area. One over the urinal he had used, the other written with a Sharpie on the map case beside the Havabite machine. Snacks, which in Alfie's opinion vended a superior product line, had for some reason been disenfranchised in the I-80 rest areas about 4 years ago. These days, Alfie sometimes went 2 weeks and 3,000 miles without seeing anything new, or even a viable variation on something old. Now two in one day. Two on the last day. Like some sort of omen. His pen had Cottager Foods, the good stuff, written in gold along the barrel next to the logo, a thatched hut with smoke coming out of the quaintly crooked chimney. Sitting there on the bed, still in his topcoat, Alfie bent studiously over his old notebook so that his shadow fell on the page. Below Don't Chew the Trojan Gum and Poopy Doopy You So Loopy, Alfie added, Save Russian Jews, Collect Valuable Prizes, Walton, Nebraska. And All That You Love Will Be Carried Away, Walton, Nebraska. He hesitated. He rarely added notes, liking his finds to stand alone. Explanation rendered the exotic mundane, or so he had come to believe. In the early years, he had annotated much more freely, but from time to time, a footnote still seemed to be more illuminating than demystifying. He starred the second entry, All That You Love Will Be Carried Away, Walton, Nebraska, and drew a line 2 inches above the bottom of the page and wrote, To read this, you must also look at the exit ramp from the Walton rest area back to highway, i.e., at departing transients. He put the pen back in his pocket, wondering why he or anyone would continue anything this close to ending everything. He couldn't think of a single answer. But of course, you went on breathing, too. You couldn't stop it without rough surgery. The wind gusted outside. Alfie looked briefly toward the window where the curtain, also green, but a different shade from the rug, had been drawn. If he pulled it back, he would be able to see chains of light on Interstate 80, each bright bead marking sentient beings running on the rod of the highway. Then he looked back down at his book. He meant to do it all right. This was just, well, breathing, he said, and smiled. He picked his cigarette out of the ashtray, smoked, returned it to the groove, and thumbed back through the book again. The entries recalled thousands of truck stops and roadside chicken shacks and highway rest areas the way certain songs on the radio can bring back specific memories of a place, a time, the person you were with, what you were drinking, what you were thinking. Here I sit, broken-hearted, tried to shit but only farted. Everyone knew that one. But here was an interesting variation from Double D Steaks in Hooker, Oklahoma. Here I sit, I'm at a loss, trying to shit out taco sauce. I know I'm going to drop a load, only hope I don't explode. And from Casey, Iowa, where SR-25 crossed I-80. My mother made me a whore, to which someone had added in very different penmanship. If I supply the yarn, will she make me one? He had started collecting when he was selling the UPCs, noting various bits of graffiti in the spiral notebook without at first knowing why he was doing it. They were just amusing, or disconcerting, or both at the same time. Yet little by little he had become fascinated with these messages from the interstate, where the only other communications seemed to be dipped headlights when you passed in the rain, or maybe somebody in a bad mood flipping you the bird when you went by in the passing lane pulling a rooster tail of snow behind you. He came gradually to see, or perhaps only to hope, that something was going on here. The E.E. Cummings lilt of Poopy Doopy, You So Loopy, for instance, or the inarticulate rage of 1380 West Avenue, Kill My Mother, Take Her Jewels. Or take this oldie. Here I sit, cheeks a-flexin', giving birth to another Texan. The meter, when you considered it, was odd. Not iams, but some odd triplet formula with the stress on the third. Here I sit, cheeks a-flexin', giving birth to another Texan. Okay, it broke down a little at the end, but that somehow added to its memorability, gave it that final mnemonic twist of the tail. He had thought on many occasions that he could go back to school, take some courses, get all that feet and meter stuff down pat, know what he was talking about instead of running on a tightrope of intuition. All he really remembered clearly from school was iambic pentameter. To be or not to be. That is the question. He had seen that in a men's room on I-70, actually, to which someone had added, "The real question is who your father was, dipstick." These triplets now, what were they called? Was that trochaic? He didn't know. The fact that he could find out no longer seemed important, but he could find out, yes. It was something people taught. It was no big secret. Or take this variation, which Alfie had also seen all over the country. "Here I sit on the pooper giving birth to a Maine state trooper." It was always Maine, no matter where you were. It was always Maine state trooper. And why? Because no other state would scan. Maine was the only one of the 50 whose name consisted of a single syllable. Yet again, it was in triplets. "Here I sit on the pooper." He had thought of writing a book, just a little one. The first title to occur to him had been, "Don't Look Up Here, You're Pissing on Your Shoes." But you couldn't call a book that. Not in reasonably hope that someone would put it out for sale in a store, anyway. And besides, that was light, frothy. He had become convinced over the years that something was going on here, and it wasn't frothy. The title he had finally decided on was an adaptation of something he'd seen in a rest area toilet stall outside of Fort Scott, Kansas, on Highway 54. "I Killed Ted Bundy, The Secret Transit Code of America's Highways," by Alfred Zimmer. That sounded mysterious and ominous, almost scholarly. But he hadn't done it. And although he had seen "If I Supply the Yarn, Will She Make Me One," added to "My Mother Made Me a Whore" all over the country, he had never expounded, at least in writing, on the startling lack of sympathy, the just-deal-with-it sensibility of the response. Or what about "Mammon is the King of New Jersey"? How did one explain why New Jersey made it funny, and the name of some other state probably wouldn't? Even to try seemed almost arrogant. He was just a little man, after all, with a little man's job. He sold things, a line of frozen dinners, currently. And now, of course, now. Alfie took another deep drag on his cigarette, mashed it out, and called home. He didn't expect to get Maura, and didn't. It was his own recorded voice that answered him, ending with the number of his cell phone. A lot of good that would do. The cell phone was in the trunk of the Chevrolet, broken. He had never had good luck with gadgets. After the beep, he said,
"Hi, it's me. I'm in Lincoln. It's snowing. Remember the casserole you were going to take over to my mother? She'll be expecting it. And she asked for the Red Ball coupons. I know you think she's crazy on that subject, but humor her, okay? She's old. Tell Carlene Daddy says hi." He paused, and then for the first time in about 5 years added, "I love you."
He hung up, thought about another cigarette, no worries about lung cancer, not now, and decided against it. He put the notebook open to the last page beside the telephone. He picked up the gun and rolled out the cylinder, fully loaded. He snapped the cylinder back in with a flick of his wrist, then slipped the short barrel into his mouth. It tasted of oil and metal. He thought, "Here I sit about to cool it, my plan to eat a fucking bullet." He grinned around the barrel. That was terrible. He never would have written that down in his book. Then another thought occurred to him, and he put the gun back in its trench on the pillow, drew the phone to him again, and once more dialed home. He waited for his voice to recite the useless cell phone number, then said,
"Me again. Don't forget Rambo's appointment at the vet day after tomorrow, okay? Also the sea jerky strips at night. They really do help his hips. Bye."
He hung up and raised the gun again. Before he could put the barrel in his mouth, his eye fell on the notebook. He frowned and put the gun down. The book was open to the last four entries. The first thing anyone responding to the shot would see would be his dead body, sprawled across the bed closest to the bathroom, his head hanging down and bleeding on the nubbly green rug. The second thing, however, would be the spiral notebook. open to the final written page. Alfie imagined some cop, some Nebraska state trooper who would never be written about on any bathroom wall due to the disciplines of scansion, reading those final entries, perhaps turning the battered old notebook toward him with the tip of his own pen. He would read the first three entries, Trojan Gum, Poopy Doopy, Save Russian Jews, and dismiss them as insanity. He would read the last line, All That You Love Will Be Carried Away, and decide that the dead guy had regained a little rationality at the end, just enough to write a halfway sensible suicide note. Alfie didn't like the idea of people thinking he was crazy. Further examination of the book, which contained such information as Medgar Evers is alive and well in Disneyland, would only confirm that impression. He was not crazy, and the things he had written here over the years weren't crazy either. He was convinced of it. And if he was wrong, if these were the rantings of lunatics, they needed to be examined even more closely. That thing about don't look up here, you're pissing on your shoes, for instance. Was that humor? Or a growl of rage? He considered using the John to get rid of the notebook, then shook his head. He'd end up on his knees with his shirt sleeves rolled back, fishing around in there, trying to get the damn thing back out, while the fan rattled and the fluorescent buzzed. And although immersion might blur some of the ink, it wouldn't blur all of it, not enough. Besides, the notebook had been with him so long, riding in his pocket across so many flat and empty Midwest miles. He hated the idea of just flushing it away. The last page, then? Surely one page, balled up, would go down. But that would leave the rest for them. There was always a them to discover. All that clear evidence of an unsound mind. They'd say, lucky he didn't decide to visit a schoolyard with an AK-47, take a bunch of little kids with him. And it would follow Maura like a tin can tied to a dog's tail. Did you hear about her husband, they'd ask each other in the supermarket? Killed himself in a motel? Left a book full of crazy stuff? Lucky he didn't kill her. Well, he could afford to be a little hard about that. Maura was an adult, after all. Carlene, on the other hand, Carlene was... Alfie looked at his watch. At her JV basketball game, that's where Carlene was right now. Her teammates would say most of the same things the supermarket ladies would say, only within earshot and accompanied by those chilling seventh-grade giggles, eyes full of glee and horror. Was that fair? No, of course not. But there was nothing fair about what had happened to him, either. Sometimes when you were cruising along the highway, you saw big curls of rubber that had unwound from the recap tires some of the independent truckers used. That was what he felt like now. Thrown tread. The pills made it worse. They cleared your mind just enough for you to see what a colossal jam you were in. But I'm not crazy, he said. That doesn't make me crazy. No. Crazy might actually be better. Alfie picked up the notebook, flipped it closed, much as he had flipped the cylinder back into the .38 and sat there, tapping it against his leg. This was ludicrous. Ludicrous or not, it nagged him. The way thinking a stove burner might still be on sometimes nagged him when he was home. Nagged until he finally got up and checked and found it cold. Only this was worse. Because he loved the stuff in the notebook. Amassing graffiti, thinking about graffiti, had been his real work these last years. Not selling price code readers or frozen dinners that were really not much more than Swanson's or Freezer Queens and fancy microwavable dishes. The daffy exuberance of Helen Keller fucked her feller, for instance. Yet the notebook might be a real embarrassment once he was dead. It would be like accidentally hanging yourself in the closet because you were experimenting with a new way of jacking off and got found that way with your shorts under your feet and shit on your ankles. Some of the stuff in his notebook might show up in the newspaper, along with his picture. Once upon a time he would have scoffed at the idea, but in these days, when even Bible Belt newspapers routinely speculated about a mole on the president's penis, the notion was hard to dismiss. Burn it, then? No. He'd set off the goddamn smoke detector. Put it behind the picture on the wall. The picture of the little boy with the fishing pole and the straw hat. Alfie considered this, then nodded slowly. Not a bad idea at all. The spiral notebook might stay there for years. Then someday in the distant future it would drop out. Someone, perhaps a lodger, more likely a maid, would pick it up, curious, would flip through it. What would that person's reaction be? Shock? Amusement? Plain old head-scratching puzzlement? Alfie rather hoped for this last, because things in the notebook were puzzling. "Elvis killed Big Pussy," someone in Hackberry, Texas had written. "Serenity is being square," someone in Rapid City, South Dakota had opined. And below that, someone had written, "No, stupid. Serenity equals VA squared plus B. If V equals serenity, A equals satisfaction, and B equals sexual compatibility." Behind the picture, then. Alfie was halfway across the room when he remembered the pills in his coat pocket. And there were more in the glove compartment of the car, different kinds, but for the same thing. They were prescription drugs, but not the sort the doctor gave you if you were feeling, well, sunny. So the cops would search this room thoroughly for other kinds of drugs. And when they lifted the picture away from the wall, the notebook would drop out onto the green rug. The things in it would look even worse, even crazier, because of the pains he had taken to hide it. And they'd read the last thing as a suicide note, simply because it was the last thing. No matter where he left the book, that would happen. "Sure as shit sticks to the ass of America," as some East Texas Turnpike poet had once written. "If they find it," he said. And just like that, the answer came to him. The snow had thickened, the wind had grown even stronger, and the spark lights across the field were gone. Alfie stood beside his snow-covered car at the edge of the parking lot, with his coat billowing out in front of him. At the farm, they'd all be watching TV by now. The whole fam-damly, assuming the satellite dish hadn't blown off the barn roof, that was. Back at his place, his wife and daughter would be arriving home from Carlene's basketball game. Maura and Carlene lived in a world that had little to do with the interstates, or fast food boxes blowing down the breakdown lanes, and the sound of semis passing you at 70 and 80 and even 90 miles an hour like a Doppler whine. He wasn't complaining about it, or hoped he wasn't. He was just pointing it out. "Nobody here, even if there is," someone in Chalk Level, Missouri had written on a shithouse wall. And sometimes in those rest area bathrooms there was blood, mostly just a little, but once he had seen a grimy basin under a scratched steel mirror half filled with it. Did anyone notice? Did anyone report such things? In some rest areas, the weather report fell constantly from overhead speakers, and to Alfie, the voice giving it sounded haunted, the voice of a ghost running through the vocal cords of a corpse. In Candy, Kansas, on Route 283 in Ness County, someone had written, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock," to which someone else had added, "If you're not from Pudlisher's Clearing House, go away, you bad boy." Alfie stood at the edge of the pavement, gasping a little because the air was so cold and full of snow. In his left hand, he held the spiral notebook, bent almost double. There was no need to destroy it, after all. He would simply throw it into Farmer John's east field, here on the west side of Lincoln. The wind would help him. The notebook might carry 20 feet on the fly, and the wind could tumble it even farther before it finally fetched up against the side of the furrow and was covered. It would lie there buried all winter, long after his body had been shipped home. In the spring, Farmer John would come out this way on his tractor, the cab filled with the music of Patti Loveless, or George Jones, or maybe even Clint Black, and he would plow the spiral notebook under without seeing it, and it would disappear into the scheme of things, always supposing there was one. "Relax, it's all just the rinse cycle," someone had written beside a payphone on I-35, not far from Cameron, Missouri. Alfie drew the book back to throw it, then lowered his arm. He hated to let it go, that was the truth of it. That was the bottom line everyone was always talking about. But things were bad now. He raised his arm again, and then lowered it again. In his distress and indecision, he began to cry without being aware of it. The wind rushed around him on its way to wherever. He couldn't go on living the way he had been living, he knew that much. Not one more day. and a shot in the mouth would be easier than any living change. He knew that, too. Far easier than struggling to write a book few people, if any at all, were likely to read. He raised his arm again, cocked the hand with the notebook in it back to his ear like a pitcher preparing to throw a fastball, then stood like that. An idea had occurred to him. He would count to 60. If the sparklights of the farmhouse reappeared at any time during that count, he would try to write the book. To write a book like that, he thought, you'd have to begin by talking about how it was to measure distance and green mile markers, and the very width of the land, and how the wind sounded when you got out of your car at one of those rest areas in Oklahoma or North Dakota. How it sounded almost like words. You'd have to explicate the silence, and how the bathrooms always smelled of piss and the great hollow farts of departed travelers, and how in that silence the voices on the walls began to speak. The voices of those who had written and then moved on. The telling would hurt, but if the wind dropped and the sparklights of the farm came back, he'd do it anyway. If they didn't, he'd throw the notebook into the field, go back into room 190, just hang a left at the snacks machine, and shoot himself as planned. Either way. Alfie stood there counting to 60 inside his head, waiting to see if the wind would drop.
Death of Jack Hamilton, read by Arliss Howard.
I want you to get one thing straight from the start. What nobody on earth didn't like my pal Johnny Dillinger, except Melvin Purvis of the FBI. Purvis was J. Edgar Hoover's right-hand man, and he hated Johnny like poison. Everyone else, well, Johnny had a way of making folks like him, that's all. And he had a way of making people laugh. God makes it come right in the end, that's something he used to say. And how can you not like a guy with that kind of philosophy? But people don't want to let a man like that die. You'd be surprised how many folks still say it wasn't Johnny the feds knocked down in Chicago beside the Biograph Theater on July 22, 1934. After all, it was Melvin Purvis who'd been in charge of hunting Johnny down, and besides being mean, Purvis was a goddamn fool. The sort of man who'd try to piss out a window without remembering to open it first. You won't hear no better from me either. Little fag of a dandy, how I hated him. How we all did. We got away from Purvis and the G's after the shootout at Little Bohemia, Wisconsin, all of us. The biggest mystery of the year was how that goddamn pansy ever kept his job. Johnny once said, J. Edgar probably can't get that good a blowjob from a dame. How we laughed. Sure, Purvis got Johnny in the end, but only after setting an ambush outside the Biograph and shooting him in the back while he was running down an alley. He fell down in the muck and the cat shit and said, "How's this, then?" and died. Still, folks won't believe it. Johnny was handsome, they say, looked almost like a movie star. The fella the G's shot outside the Biograph had a fat face, all swollen up and bloated like a cooked sausage. Johnny was barely 31, they say, and the mug the cops shot that night looked 40 easy. Also, and here they drop their voices to a whisper, everyone knows John Dillinger had a pecker the size of a Louisville Slugger. That fella Purvis ambushed outside the Biograph didn't have nothing but the standard 6 inches. And then there's the matter of that scar on his upper lip. You can see it clear as day in the morgue photographs, like the one where some yo-yo is holding up my old pal's head and looking all solemn, as if to tell the world once and for all that crime does not pay. The scar cuts the side of Johnny's mustache in two. Everyone knows John Dillinger never had a scar like that, people say. Just look at any of the other pictures. God knows there's enough of them. There's even a book that says Johnny didn't die, that he lived on long after the rest of his running buddies and finished up in Mexico, living in a hacienda and pleasing any number of senoras and senoritas with his oversized tool. The book claims that my old pal died on November 20th, 1963, 2 days before Kennedy, at the ripe old age of 60, and it wasn't no federal bullet that took him off, but a plain old heart attack, that John Dillinger died in bed. It's a nice story, but it ain't true. Johnny's face looks big in those last photos because he'd really packed on the pounds. He was the type who eats when he's nervous, and after Jack Hamilton died in Aurora, Illinois, Johnny felt he was next. Said as much in that gravel pit where we took poor old Jack. As for his tool, well, I'd known Johnny ever since we met at Pendleton Reformatory in Indiana. I saw him dressed and undressed, and Homer Van Meter is here to tell you that he had a good one, but not an especially great one. I'll tell you who had a great one, if you want to know. Doc Barker, the mama's boy. Ha! Which brings me to the scar on Johnny's upper lip, the one you can see cutting through his mustache in those pictures where he's lying on the cooling board. The reason the scar doesn't show in any of Johnny's other pictures is that he got it near the end. It happened in Aurora while Jack, Red, Hamilton, our old pal, was on his deathbed. That's what I want to tell you about, how Johnny Dillinger got the scar on his upper lip. Me and Johnny and Red Hamilton got away from the little Bohemia shootout through the kitchen windows in back, making our way down the side of the lake while Purvis and his idiots were still pouring lead into the front of the lodge. Boy, I hope the crowd who owned the place had insurance. The first car we found belonged to an elderly neighbor couple, and it wouldn't start. We had better luck with the second, a Ford coupe that belonged to a carpenter just up the road. Johnny put him in the driver's seat, and he chauffeured us a good way back toward St. Paul. Then he was invited to step out, which he did quite willingly, and I took over. We crossed the Mississippi about 20 miles downriver from St. Paul, and although the local cops were all on the lookout for what they called the Dillinger Gang, I think we would have been all right if Jack Hamilton hadn't lost his hat while we were making our escape. He was sweating like a pig. He always did when he was nervous, and when he found a rag on the back seat of the carpenter's car, he whipped it into a kind of rope and tied it around his head, engine style. That was what caught the eye of those cops parked on the Wisconsin side of the spiral bridge as we went past them, and they came after us for a closer look. That might have been the end of us right there, but Johnny always had the devil's own luck, until the Biograph anyway. He put a cattle truck right between us and them, and the cops couldn't get past. "Step on it, Homer," Johnny shouts at me. He was in the back seat in a rare good humor from the sound of him. "Make it walk." I did, too, and we left the cattle truck in the dust with those cops stuck behind it. "So long, Mother. I'll write when I get work." Ha! Once it seemed we had them buried for good, Jack says, "Slow down, you damn fool. No sense getting picked up for speeding." So I slowed down to 35, and for a quarter of an hour, everything was fine. We were talking about Little Bohemia and whether or not Lester, the one they were always calling Babyface, might have gotten away, when all at once there's a crackle of rifles and pistols and the sound of bullets whining off the pavement. It was those hick cops from the bridge. They'd caught up, creeping easy the last 90 or 100 yards and were close enough now to be shooting for the tires. They probably weren't entirely sure, even then, that it was Dillinger. They weren't in doubt for long. Johnny broke out the back window of the Ford with the butt of his pistol and started shooting back. I mashed the gas pedal again and got that Ford all the way up to 50, which was a tearing rush in those days. There wasn't much traffic, but what there was I passed any way I could, on the left, on the right, in the ditch. Twice I felt the driver's side wheels go up, but we never tipped. Nothing like a Ford when it came to a getaway. Once Johnny wrote to Henry Ford himself. "When I'm in a Ford, I can make any car take my dust," he told Mr. Ford, and we surely dusted him that day. We paid a price, though. There were these spink, spink, spink noises, and a crack ran up the windshield, and a slug, I'm pretty sure it was a .45, fell dead on the dashboard. It looked like a big black elm beetle. Jack Hamilton was in the passenger seat. He got his Tommy gun off the floor and was checking the drum, ready to lean out the window, I imagine, when there came another of those spink noises. Jack says, "Oh, bastard, I'm hit." That bullet had to have come in the busted back window, and how it missed Johnny to hit Jack, I don't know. "Are you all right?" I shouted. I was hung over the wheel like a monkey and driving like one, too, very likely. I passed a coolie dairy truck on the right, honking all the time, yelling for that white-coat farmer son of a bitch to get out of my road. "Jack, are you all right?" "I'm okay. I'm fine," he says, and shoves himself and his subgun out the window almost to his waist. Only, at first, the milk truck was in the way. I could see the driver in the mirror gawking at us from under his little hat, and when I looked over at Jack as he leaned out, I could see a hole, just as neat and round as something you'd draw with a pencil, in the middle of his overcoat. There was no blood, just that little black hole. "Never mind, Jack, just run the son of a bitch," Johnny shouted at me. I ran it. We gained maybe half a mile on the milk truck, and the cops stuck behind it the whole while because there was a guardrail on one side and a line of slowpoke traffic coming the other way. We turned hard around a sharp curve, and for a moment both the milk truck and the police car were out of sight. Suddenly, on the right, there was a gravel road all grown in with weeds. "In there!" Jack gasps, falling back into the passenger seat, but I was already turning in. It was an old driveway. I drove about 70 yards over a little rise and down the other side, ending at a farmhouse that looked long empty. I killed the engine, and we all got out and stood behind the car. "If they come, we'll give them a show," Jack says. "I ain't going to no electric chair like Harry Pierpont." But no one came, and after 10 minutes or so, we got back in the car and drove out to the main road all slow and careful. And that's when I saw something I didn't like much. "Jack," I says, "you're bleeding out your mouth. Look out or it'll be on your shirt." Jack wiped his mouth with the big finger of his right hand, looked at the blood on it, and then gave me a smile that I still see in my dreams, big and broad and scared to death. "I just bit the inside of my cheek," says he. "I'm all right." "You sure?" Johnny asks. "You sound kind of funny." "I can't catch all my breath just yet," Jack says. He wiped his big finger across his mouth again, and there was less blood, and that seemed to satisfy him. "Let's get the fuck out of here." "Turn back toward the spiral bridge, Homer," Johnny says, and I did like he told me. Not all the stories about Johnny Dillinger are true, but he could always find his way home, even after he didn't have no home no more, and I always trusted him. We were once again doing a perfectly legal parson-go-to-meeting 30 miles per when Johnny saw a Texaco station and told me to turn off to the right. We were soon on country gravel roads, Johnny calling lefts and rights, even though all the roads looked the same to me, just wheel ruts running between clapped-out cornfields. The roads were muddy, and there were still scraps of snow in some of the fields. Every now and then there'd be some hick kid watching us go by. Jack was getting quieter and quieter. I asked him how he was doing, and he said, "I'm all right." "Yes, well, we ought to get you looked at when we cool off a little," Johnny said. "And we have to get your coat mended, too. With that hole in it, it looks like somebody shot you. He laughed. So did I. Even Jack laughed. Johnny could always cheer you up. I don't think it went deep, Jack said just as we came out on Route 43. I'm not bleeding out my mouth anymore. Look. He turned to show Johnny his finger, which now just had a maroon smear on it. But when he twisted back into his seat, blood poured out of his mouth and nose. I think it went deep enough, Johnny said. We'll take care of you. If you can still talk, you're likely fine. Sure, Jack said. I'm fine. His voice was smaller than ever. Fine as a fiddler's fuck, I said. Ah, shut up, you dummox, he said, and we all had a laugh. They laughed at me a lot. It was all in fun. About 5 minutes after we got back on the main road, Jack passed out. He slumped against the window and a thread of blood trickled from one corner of his mouth and smeared on the glass. It reminded me of swatting a mosquito that's had its dinner, the claret everywhere. Jack still had the rag on his head, but it had gone crooked. Johnny took it off and cleaned the blood from Jack's face with it. Jack muttered and raised his hands as if to push Johnny away, but they dropped back into his lap. Those cops will have radioed ahead, Johnny says. If we go to St. Paul, we're finished. That's what I think. How about you, Homer? The same, I says. What does that leave, Chicago? Yep, he says. Only first we have to ditch this motor. They'll have the plates by now. Even if they didn't, it's bad luck. It's a damn hoodoo. What about Jack? I says. Jack will be all right, he says, and I knew to say no more on the subject. We stopped about a mile down the road, and Johnny shot out the front tire of the Hoodoo Ford while Jack leaned against the hood, looking pale and sick. When we needed a car, it was always my job to flag one down. People who wouldn't stop for any of the rest of us will stop for you, Johnny said once. Why is that, I wonder? Harry Pierpont answered him. This was back in the days when it was still the Pierpont gang instead of the Dillinger gang. Because he looks like a Homer, he said. Wasn't ever anyone look so much like a Homer as Homer Van Meter does. We all laughed at that, and now here I was again, and this time it was really important. You'd have to say life or death. Three or four cars went by, and I pretended to be fiddling with the tire. A farm truck was next, but it was too slow and waddly. Also, there were some fellas in the back. Driver slows down and says, "You need any help, amigo?" "I'm fine," I says, "working up an appetite for lunch. You go right on." He gives me a laugh, and on he went. The fellas in the back also waved. Next up was another Ford, all by its lonesome. I waved my arms for them to stop, standing where they couldn't help but see that flat shoe. Also, I was giving them a grin. That big one that says, "I'm just a harmless Homer," by the side of the road. It worked. The Ford stopped. There was three folks inside, a man and a young woman and a fat baby. A family. "Looks like you got a flat there, partner," the man says. He was wearing a suit and a top coat, both clean, but not what you'd call grade A. "Well, I don't know how bad it can be," I says, "when it's only flat on the bottom." We was still laughing over that, just like it was new, when Johnny and Jack come out of the trees with their guns drawn. "Just hold still, sir," Jack says. "No one is going to get hurt." The man looked at Jack, looked at Johnny, looked at Jack again. Then his eyes went back to Johnny and his mouth dropped open. I seen it 1,000 times, but it always tickled me. "You're Dillinger," he gasps, and then shoots his hands up. "Pleased to meet you, sir," Johnny says, and grabs one of the man's hands out of the air. "Get those mitts down, would you?" Just as he did, another two or three cars came along. Country go-to-town types, sitting up straight as sticks in their old muddy sedans. We didn't look like nothing but a bunch of folks at the side of the road getting ready for a tire-changing party. Jack, meanwhile, went to the driver's side of the new Ford, turned off the switch, and took the keys. The sky was white that day, as if with rain or snow, but Jack's face was whiter. "What's your name, ma'am?" Jack asked the woman. She was wearing a long gray coat and a cute sailor's cap.